Hello and welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in with me this morning is Adri Roberts. She's Cache County's Extension Family and Consumer Sciences Agent. And we're beginning another module, and I just love to come up with names for these things. This one is called Yes, You Can, and we're going to, as part of that, talk about food preservation. And Adri, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
So one of the first things, I guess the big question is, so why do people can or preserve? Why should we? What things should we be thinking about? Because as I've done this through the years, I say, but it's usually ends up being my wife who does most of it. I just help out with the snipping of the beans.
And eating,
of course. That it's not always the least expensive option.
Right. Well, I think a lot of it's tradition. You know, I think that, you know, once you've had some good freezer jam, you don't want to go to the store necessarily and buy it. Or once people have a real preference, if you like your bottled green beans better than a can of green beans, you do it for preference. I think we do it because of tradition. Our moms or our grandmas or whatever did it, and we like their recipes or their way of doing things. Sometimes I think people feel really obligated that I've got to get this. My husband will bring me in a bushel of whatever, and he would say, "Be ashamed to waste this," and I'd say, "Oh yeah," because I know that means me canning it. So I think we do it for a lot of different reasons. The experts, though, recommend that if you're doing it to save money, you're probably not, unless you can get the produce free. So if you have an apple tree in your backyard and you're making applesauce, it's a good deal. If you're growing the green beans out in your garden and you've got plenty to put in the jar and call it good, then that's probably okay. But if you're having to go and pay $25 a bushel for your peaches or, you know, whatever, it's probably not the most economical thing to do. Of course, most of us say it tastes a lot better than a can of peaches. But
how much of that is psychological versus reality?
I think there's, in Utah especially, it's a lot psychological too. So anyway, it's just something you kind of need to decide. If you enjoy it, do it. There's a lot of satisfaction in seeing those pretty jars in a row that you've just bottled. There's a lot of satisfaction in having your family enjoy the things that you've made. So you just have to kind of decide if it's worth the trade-off, your time and things like that. I spent Saturday half the day making some jelly, and I thought, did I really want to do this? Was this really that important? Could I have spent my time another way? And in ways, I probably wish I had. But at the same time, it's hard to look at this fruit that was, you know, getting ready to be canned or thrown out and not do something with it. So, you know, you just have to evaluate your values and decide what you want to do.
My wife and I are reaching that point where having all of those fruit trees in the garden may not necessarily be the best thing. I guess I could always tell the neighbors, come and get it. Mm-hmm. But when you've got like 7 apple trees,
wow.
Well, what do you do with all the fruit? And right. We've got the pears were just awesome this year.
Oh,
and
great.
So we're looking at the tree going, okay, did we eat everything that we had last year? So we only have one child left at home. So It's just the three of us.
Yeah, you have to kind of question if it's worth it or not.
Yeah.
So,
although I will say, oh yes, everything we can tastes much better than in the store.
Right. Well, but it does take time.
We'd love to have your questions or comments. It's 1-800-826-1495. You can also go to Utah Public Radio's Facebook page and leave your question or comment there, or send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. So if you wanted to start out, you've never done this before, what's the first thing that you would recommend for someone to start with? What kind of, is it freezer jam? Is it beans? What would you have them do?
You know, I think I would have them do freezer jam. Just buy a box of Pectin and follow the directions really closely. Don't make any changes or to that recipe because it won't work. The Pectin recipes are just right to a T, and if you add a little more fruit or anything like that, it's gonna not set up. So I would start with freezer jam. You don't have to go buy special bottles or anything. You can use little freezer containers, and you can use leftover jars of, you know, from whatever you've got. So that would be a great way to start. I would definitely start using recipes that only have to be boiling water bath, not pressure canned. So that would be all of the higher acid foods like peaches and pears and those types of things. When you get into the meat and the vegetables, you've got to have a pressure canner. They have to be cooked at that higher temperature to kill the botulism spores. which is deadly. And so you've got to get a pressure counter for that. But I definitely wouldn't start out using a pressure counter. It has to be watched very carefully. And I don't mean to scare anyone off, but it's something that takes time and real consideration when you're going to pressure count. So buy a boiling water bath canner and a good pan to...
So what does that look like?
That looks like a black pan with the lid. It's fairly tall. It has probably
little speckles.
Yeah, little speckles all over it. There is a canner rack inside that you can put your jars on and lower it down into the water. You can usually get those for under $25. If you watch the sales, you can get them for about $20. And that's what I would start out with, is just a good boiling water bath canner. Utah State University does not recommend the use of the steam canner, and they are really popular. People love their steam canners, but Utah State University just does not feel like there's been enough research on their safety. They are concerned about whether the heat is penetrating the bottle and getting the product hot enough to be safe.
So I've seen some of the concerns, like the outside of the bottle might be okay, but the one on the inside, that heat's not getting all the way to the center.
Right,
And getting up as much as it needs to.
Right, especially thicker things like applesauce or... And definitely never use the steam canner on tomato products or meat, vegetables. So we just recommend you just start out with a good boiling water bath.
So we've got that canner. Stock pot?
I recommend you get a good pan, and you can probably get that at a secondhand store. It needs to be a good heavy one, though, so your things aren't scorching. Needs to be... fairly large, because you're going to be blanching food, you're going to be making jam in it, you're going to be, blanching tomatoes and getting the skins off, things like that. So you need a good pan, but you don't necessarily have to spend a lot of money. It needs to be sturdy, though.
A colander,
because you are washing everything, you're rinsing it off, you're... As you get the skin off of tomatoes, you put them in boiling water, wait till that skin breaks, and then you put it into ice water, then you drain it off, pull the skin off. Anyway, you're just going to use a colander a lot, so it's important to get one of those, fairly large if you can afford it.
And the knives and cutting boards?
Those are important. There's a lot of chopping involved. Yeah, make sure you've got a sharp knife. I know there are different places here in Cache Valley that will sharpen your knife. And for a fairly minimal cost, but you're going to be chopping a lot.
It's well worth it.
Yeah.
Well worth
yeah.
it. So when would you bring a strainer into this? Like there are different brands. Vittorio is one you see mm-hmm. quite a bit. And mm-hmm. that's the one, it has the little spiral thing. You put the food in it, like if you're doing applesauce, you've cooked your apples, you put your apples through the top, and then you turn the grinder and it comes out with the sauce. How necessary would something like that be?
It's very helpful. If you totally get into canning after using your boiling water bath, then maybe possibly look into investing in one. Most of the extension offices in Utah have one that they will rent out or lend out. You can check out and borrow and see if you like it. We have, I think, a couple in our office here in Cache Valley that you can rent for $1 a day. So I wouldn't invest until you've borrowed used one, because it's a little bit more complicated, but it sure makes canning a lot easier.
I'm the person that usually ends up cleaning that.
Oh.
And if you've let it dry instead of doing it right.
Yeah. It's not fun.
Yeah. No, but it does. They do make, you can do juices and mm-hmm. The applesauce. We said so many different things with them.
Oh, yeah. They're great. They really
are. Salsas work out really well. Okay. Yeah. So anything else as far as the basics? I guess we need to talk about the bottles.
Right. Canning jars. I recommend that you get brand new ones. Sometimes we don't know what those canning jars have been through that we buy at yard sales. I just sold a bunch at a yard sale, but the people were very careful about checking them out. But I recommend that you get brand new ones. Usually we recommend the Baller, the Kerr, the Mason, but I understand the Golden Harvest are fine, and I know Walmart has a brand now that they are selling. So I would just invest in good brand new jars.
They're just so dang expensive.
They are, but once you made that investment, you got them forever.
So if you are looking, even with your own jars, it's always good to do this. I see my wife running her finger mm-hmm. around the top. to see if there are any chips and on the inside.
Right.
What else are you looking for?
If
they look well used, probably not so
much.
Yeah,
don't. A lot of times, you know, we take a fork down and grab a pickle or whatever through the ears, and eventually those sides can kind of get a little used, and eventually that might form a weak point, and the jar could break during processing, and then there goes your product that's inside the jar and all your time. And so just keep a good close eye on them, and do run your finger around the top to make sure that there's no chips.
I've indoctrinated my two kids. So the three of us are against my wife. No pickles in our house.
Oh. Well, that's too bad.
Oh, no. My life is much better, except for my wife. She loves pickles, so she has to get them elsewhere. I don't grow pickling cucumbers.
Okay.
Okay. So with the lids, that's probably the part that just irritates me the most is how expensive those lids have gotten. And the manufacturers have consolidated. So, you know, Ball and Kerr used to be rival companies, and Ball bought Kerr. So the price goes up. Are there any – what do you look for in the lids? Can you just buy the least expensive ones?
I would not. In fact, I get a lot of calls on the Golden Harvest when I hate to put out brand names, but sometimes they don't seal as well. I would highly recommend that you get the Ball lids. And, you know, sometimes you can – watch the sales towards the end of the season, get 20% off, 50% off. And those lids will be okay if you use them the following fall. And so, for example, I was in a local store the other day and they had all their canning things half off. So I got a nice little stash.
Wow.
So look around and kind of prepare for the coming year for what you're going to use. You don't want to store these lids for years and years and years because the rubber around them starts getting hard and they don't seal as well, but they would be fine for a year. So watch for those sales.
Now, the other thing I noticed was, and this is like 15 years ago, there was a transition in those lids from having them in boiling water to have them only in very hot water. And because I had a friend who says, these lids don't work anymore. And I said, are you boiling them? Well, yes, because that's what she'd been doing. Mm-hmm. You don't boil them anymore. It's just very hot.
Right.
Are there any techniques to make sure that things seal? Sometimes we just can't figure out why did they all seal except that one.
Well, you know, I get a lot of calls on people that have had bottles that haven't sealed or that they have a high percentage that don't. And one of the things that we have determined is they're screwing the band on too tight. And nothing against men, but, you know, they want to give that lid another tight squeeze, and that's sometimes too tight. It needs to be snug, but don't grind down on it. And I know women can do it too, so I don't want to be sexist, but that's one of the things that can cause a problem. If you haven't heated that lid up a little bit before you put it on, that makes a big difference. When I try to narrow it down with people to find out why their bottles hadn't sealed, I find that some of them are not having a hot product in the jars. Oh. So if you have your green beans in there, you need to make sure you put boiling water on top of them. If you're bottling salsa, the salsa needs to be hot in a hot jar.
So they're doing the beans like a cold pack, but they're not putting hot water on top of them?
They're putting the cold water, yeah.
Oh,
or they're not following through. If you're canning, you need to be able to follow through the whole process, you know, in fairly good order. So they'll get several bottles of peaches ready and pour the hot liquid on and then go pick up the kids from school and then come back. Well, it's all cooled off. And if you have a hot product in your jar, then when it goes into the boiling water bath, it's going to suck that lid down and that will give you a good vacuum seal. So that's what you want is as hot a product as you can get in there so it will suck that lid down.
Mm. What fruits or vegetables do you usually see issues with? Or does it make any difference?
It can just vary. As far as sealing,
you mean?
Yes,
uh-huh.
Just it honestly can just happen with anything that they haven't used the hot liquid to put on or the liquid's not hot in the jar. I had a lady call the other day. She made her salsa one night, was really tired, put it in the fridge, got up the next morning, put the salsa in cold into the jar, and then processed it, and hardly any of her lids sealed.
Oh, yeah.
So we finally narrowed it down that the salsa was cold, and she fix that.
So it's something you need to do in one continual process.
Right.
You can't just start it and then leave it go.
Right, right. And, you know, I get a lot of questions about, I had a lot of lids not seal, and that was 3 or 4 weeks ago. What am I going to do now? Well, probably you're going to throw it out. If you have done it in less than 24 hours ago, then you're able to redo it. You need to put a new lid on, and
so
then you can reprocess it.
Okay.
The problem is, again, though, that product has probably cooled down. The ideal would be for you to go ahead and dump it out, heat it up, put it back in the jar, try again. A lot of people don't want to go to that work. So I just say open up your jar, throw the contents in a freezer Ziploc bag, and throw it in your freezer.
or stick it in the fridge and you're going to have beans a lot
right.
the next week.
Yeah. Right, right. Use it up as soon as possible if you put it in the fridge. So.
Well, you're listening to The Zesty Garden. Adri Roberts is Cache County's Extension Family and Consumer Sciences agent. If you'd like to join our conversation, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495. You can also go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and do your question or comment there. Or you can send us an email at zestygarden@gmail.com. And we have a question from Kurt. And Kurt says, can you give examples of places in Cache Valley who do knife sharpening? Do you know anyone who will teach me how to sharpen kitchen knives?
Kitchen Neat, I know, sharpens knives. I think that Wimmer Sewing Machine Store on Main Street also sharpens knives. I know they sharpen scissors. I would assume if they can sharpen scissors, they can sharpen knives. I'm not really sure of others, and I'm sure there are others, and I'm sorry if you're a business and I've left you out, but I do know of those two locations.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about reusable lids, which have come out in the last 10 years or so. And if you have any kind of data on them to see how well they work, if they're recommended, what can you tell me about them? Because I've seen them online.
We have no idea. They haven't been tested. We don't know how long the seal will last. The USDA goes through really extensive research before they say something is okay or not okay. So it's kind of use at your own risk type of thing. I know it's the answer to many people's prayers if we could get a reusable lid. And those who have used them seem to really like them. But at this point, we just have to say we don't know. It's at your own
risk. So if you're
risk.
Interested, I mean, they are pretty expensive mm-hmm. up front, even more so than regular lids.
Right.
But if they'll last a while, that could really make a big
dip. It could. So it would be nice if they would test them and do some research on it so we can decide whether they are safe or not.
So there aren't any minimum standards for, I mean, any company could just say these are lids that are reusable.
Right.
And I guess for them, they have to test them themselves because they're going to go out of business if it doesn't work.
Right, right.
Okay, I know we've bought some, and it's been about 4 years, and we still use the other lids, and we've used some of those, just still kind of testing them out. So so far so good, but it's only been 4 years.
Okay,
and we eat our product a lot, so they're not sitting in the basement,
right?
For that long a time.
Right.
So
yeah, I think it would be great if they would. Go ahead and test them. But like I said, with my job and our link with the USDA, we can't recommend anything that hasn't been thoroughly investigated.
Do you know of any testing that's going on with these lids?
No.
Okay.
I don't. And there could be maybe a university extension somewhere is doing it, but not that I have heard.
So I need to ask you, we've only got a couple minutes left, about using tested recipes. When we first started getting into canning, you know, my mother had this recipe and my grandmother had that recipe, but I found out pretty quickly that the recommendation is it might taste really good and that salsa might be great fresh, but don't even try to can it without using a tested recipe.
Right. We just highly recommend that you get with your extension office and get those USDA recipes. We can say that the ball canning book is okay. You have to be really careful with the ball canning book because the recipes within the book are at sea level. They do have a little chart that shows you how to add for elevation. So make sure if you're using those that you do add for the elevation. But your local extension office will have the best recipes for you to use. For example, I have a lot of people that complain that the legal salsa recipes are too vinegarish or lemonish. And so we have, me and my interns have made several of them and taste tested them, and we found some pretty good ones. We have a sheet of good recipes that are approved that we've tested.
Because what's going to happen if you use your own?
If the acid's not right, and because it's a tomato product, the pH level isn't right, it could be deadly.
And the modern tomatoes, the pH levels are low.
Right.
They're not up like they used to be.
Right, because they're breeding tomatoes to taste better fresh, because we're eating so many more fresh tomatoes with this nice nutrition era that's come to pass. And so you've just got to be really careful whatever you put into a bottle.
So I have also, we have both the ball and the Kerr book.
Okay.
Is the Kerr book still okay? I mean, this is from like 10 years ago that we still have it, but.
Yeah, as long as that's all the older it is. If you have anything before 1988, it's way outdated. The USDA went through and tested and changed and did a lot of changes in 1988. So if you're using a recipe book from 1975 or 1962, you are really behind the times and need some updated information. We'd be happy to set you up with some good stuff.
And you've got actually quite a few publications down there. I mean, you have the book, the ball book, but you also have smaller publications that are produced.
We do. And we have a gorgeous USDA canning guide that is spiral bound. They're $16.50, but it would be a once-in-a-lifetime event, purchase.
Yeah.
And then you would have the good tested recipes. So, yeah, we've got a little bit of everything. We have recipe pamphlets from Washington and that are approved, so we'd love to help set you up.
So in 30 seconds, parting words on canning your own spaghetti sauce.
Be very careful if you're canning your own spaghetti sauce, because we don't add extra acid to it, and so it must be pressure canned, and it should be a tested and approved recipe from the USDA or Ball. And so if you're canning spaghetti sauce, be very careful about what recipe you're using, and for sure make sure it's pressure canned.
Okay. Adri, thank you very much.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Adri Roberts is Cache County's Extension Family and Consumer Sciences agent, and she's part of a new segment, and it's called Yes, You Can, and we'll be talking about food preservation throughout the year. In our gardening calendar, the Tahlequah Nature Center is holding a Fall is for Planting and Planning class this Saturday. The class is free and focuses on color and landscapes that you can utilize in your garden this winter. The Tahlequah Nature Center is at 1851 South Dixie Drive. And starting on October 3rd, Thanksgiving Point is holding a hobby greenhouse series. The series runs the first four Fridays of October. Come learn how to keep growing your plants with the weather turning cooler. The class cost is $45 for adults. And then on the 11th, the Stokes Nature Center is hiking up Logan Canyon to discuss what makes leaves change their color and nature surrounding the fall season. The cost is $5. To register, go to logannature.org. And there are still farmers markets this time of year. The Mapleton Farmers Market is held every Saturday through the month of October at 125 West 400 North in Mapleton. Coming up next is the Green Room segment, and we're going to learn about Dracaena. So stay tuned. You're listening to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in with me today is Shane Taylor, horticultural specialist and buyer for Cactus and Tropicals in Salt Lake City. And we are continuing our series of looking at houseplants that are great for people to consider. And this next one that is on the list, it looks like a miniature, what I would call an elephant palm, except the leaves are a little bit different. So let's take a look at this one. What is it?
Well, that's a Dracaena marginata right there. And often when people are trying to describe it over the phone and don't know the name, they describe it to us as a palm tree. Unfortunately, it's not a palm tree, but the way that they're pruned and the way that they're grown often will resemble a palm tree. And I had to include at least one Dracaena in this, just because Dracaenas are a huge family of very hardy plants.
It's like a tricolor.
This is a tricolor, yeah. Marginata normally has a narrow green leaf with a red stripe down the outside, which is why they call it marginata. But this one, not only does it have the red stripe, but it also has some white stripes in the leaf, and so they call it the tricolor. And Dracaena marginata was one of the first houseplants I ever owned. It's one that I bought. I took it home. I did the thing you never should do, and I immediately transplanted my little 4-inch marginata into a great big pot and then had to figure out why it didn't do so well, why it started struggling. And fortunately, through my novice plant skill, it survived. And although it went through periods of root rot and periods where it actually had bacterial infections that caused pieces of the plant to go mushy, it survived. And I still have it to this day. It's one of those plants that—
In that same pot?
Well, it's actually in that same big, giant pot, yes. They're great. They're amazing. They are—
Why don't you describe how it looks like? So I'm looking at it. It looks like a trunk that's been cut off.
Yeah, you've got what they call a cane, which is just a piece of trunk. And what they'll do is they'll grow these canes places like Costa Rica, somewhere down in Central South America, and they'll cut pieces of them, like six-inch pieces of cane. And the growers will take and they'll stick those pieces of cane in soil here in the United States, and they'll let them grow for a little while, and at the top of that naked piece of cane, you'll suddenly get all these little shoots that come up and produce leaves. And so it really does look like a trunk with a bunch of palm tree leaves at top. It's a great little plant. And
this is like someone took a really cool-looking feather duster and stuck it in the soil because of the way that the leaves have just kind of opened up.
Yeah, that's a good description. That actually does describe it really well. But the thing that really makes Dracaena marginata and a lot of the other varieties of Dracaena special is that they can adapt to so many different situations in the house, in the office. Again, they're one of those common plants, but they're common for a reason. They're common because they're hardy. And one of the benefits of being common is people are often hybridizing, they're cross-pollinating and trying to find different colors. And so you'll find them now that are hot pink, and you'll find them now that have yellow in the leaf, and you'll just a lot of different colors that are possible with this type of plant. Anything from even just the regular plain green. And like other plants, the more variegated the leaf is, of course, the brighter the light they need. But this specific variety, this Dracaena marginata tricolor, would be suitable for medium light, high light, or even some direct sun. The brighter the light, the faster it's going to grow and the faster mm-hmm. it's going to use its water. Of course, if it's in medium light, it's going to grow a little bit slower and it's going to want to go longer between waterings. And it's another one of those plants that you want to let it dry out. You want to feel the surface of the soil and make sure that the soil surface is dry between watering. But it will react to life on a regular schedule a little bit better than some other things. So it's kind of like pothos in that. You can water it once a week if you want to stick it on a schedule, and it will do fine. It will do great. Of course, make sure you drain it well. That can always be an issue. And a good watering practice also ensures that you're watering until you see water come out of the bottom. Because one of the quirks of many types of Dracaena is that they're sensitive to fluoride. And there are many places in Utah and in other, places with big cities where they'll fluoridate water, and you'll get orange, dark orange spots on the leaves if you let that fluoride build up in the soil. So by flushing it, by watering it so that you flush water through, you prevent that from happening, and it keeps the plant a lot healthier.
Can you just water with, bottled water that doesn't— it's just straight water, doesn't have all the minerals in it?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. But watering with bottled or distilled water can have consequences as well, because plants actually do use calcium similar to the way we do. They fortify their cell wall with calcium. So it's a good idea to at least give it some mineral. If you are using bottled water, adding fertilizer every so often, just a mild houseplant food, just all purpose. Would be a good idea for any of the Dracaena family plants. They do like to be fed. Of course, don't overfeed. Always follow the directions.
How do you know when it's gotten too big? I mean, do you ever reach a point where you cut it yourself and have it start over again?
Yes, absolutely. And that's one of the things that on this specific specimen where you can see where its main stalk has been cut, and so it's got all these little substalks sticking out the side. And mine has reached my ceiling. So I have had to cut it back a couple times.
So is
now.
It just one cane all the way up and then on the top?
It was when it started, but now it is about 20 canes because I keep cutting it back. And every time I cut it back, it branches. And so what was once just a, you know, a scrawny, spindly plant has now got trunks and it's got multiple branches. And you can see those stump areas where I've cut it back here and there. And over time, I've tried to cut the trunks at different heights so that I have foliage down low, I have foliage in the middle, and I have foliage up high.
It's like this one. It's got the one cut, and then there are four smaller little trunks coming out from it, or canes. And so then at one point, maybe you would cut one of those. You'd let one go a little bit higher. I mean, it's...
Yeah, right there. Okay. If you cut one of them, as the other ones keep growing, it's going to take it a little bit time for that to regrow. So that will always be a little bit lower at that point. So you can stagger the way that they look over time by just cutting now and then. When I rotted it, when I almost killed it, I actually had to cut the whole thing back because I had so much rot on it. I thought I had lost it. And I replaced the soil at that point and put it back in fresh soil. And it had to restart from the main trunk, which caused the main trunk to get thicker and thicker over time because it's what all of the smaller trunks come out of. So they call that a stump over time. So you've got a stump and cane growth.
So this is a Dracaena.
This is a Dracaena. Yeah, Dracaena marginata.
And that's our recommended plant for this week's program. And Shane Taylor is the horticultural specialist and buyer with Cactus and Tropicals in Salt Lake City. Thanks, Shane.
Thanks, Brian.
We're going to take a quick break, but then we'll be back and you'll hear the next segment of Going Native, and we're going to talk about the pinyon pine. You're listening to The Zesty Garden, and it's our Going Native segment, and in studio with me is Jeanette Warner of Wildland Nursery. It's just south of Richfield in Joseph. Our plant to talk about today is the pinyon pine, and I actually have a couple of two-needle pinions that are in my yard, and let's talk about this. Why would you suggest grow a pinion?
Lots of reasons. One reason that I always tell people about is it might be slow growing, but when it's full grown, it's not going to overgrow your landscape. And you don't have to spend your retirement money cutting out a pine tree that overgrew your neighborhood.
Mm. And the ones that we have are probably, let's see, we lived in that house 17 years. They're probably about 13 or 14 years old. They're maybe 10 feet tall.
Right. Perfect size.
Yeah. And I keep waiting for them to put some cones on.
They probably will soon.
Good. Well, and they're wonderful where they are. And I'm a hose dragger, so my lawn, they're in the lawn, but we've cut the sod out from around the base of them. So they get the water that the lawn gets, and they do great. They haven't rotted or anything like that. So this is a great one that you can grow in a desert location, but also in the home garden.
And, you know, when you consider watering with your sprinkling systems for your lawn, how deep do you water?
Well, for me, I water less but more deeply because I want that water to soak through and get past the lawn because the lawn outcompetes quite a few plants in the landscape.
So when you water your lawn, you're not watering to water that tree though, right?
Right. You're watering to
and
for the
so,
lawn itself.
So basically that tree's quite drought tolerant in that lawn because you're not watering to water the tree.
How large would you say it will eventually get?
I have seen them where I live, really beautiful old ones, maybe 25 feet tall.
At the most?
At the most, okay. Yes. And maybe 15 feet wide. In the home landscape, they won't get that large. And also, with that little water, regular care, they will become more formal shaped. They won't be as angular and gangly as you might see them out in the wild. And they become more formal and domesticated almost.
And it's zones 4 through 8?
At least, yes. Maybe even a little bit, maybe zone 3. They said that they wouldn't grow in Park City. my friend up there is going to try anything, and she has a pinion growing up there, doing very nicely in her yard.
And it's doing okay.
Yes.
Okay, good. And average size, 25 to 30 feet tall, 10 to 50 feet wide. What I want are the pine nuts.
Right.
So when did the cones with the nuts first start showing up?
I think that my trees are probably 15, 20 years old, and I've been getting pine cones with nuts in them for the last 3 to 4 years.
Okay. So.
But if you want the pine nuts that are really big, you need to get the Pinus monophylla from the Sierra Nevadas.
Oh,
the single needle pinion are the ones that grow in western Utah and Nevada are the ones that have the big pine nuts.
Okay, so my two-needle pinion, they're going to produce pine nuts, but they're not going to be all that big.
They're not going to be the giant ones, but they're fun.
Well,
they're
fun. I'll feed the birds.
Right, you will. Uh-huh.
Hopefully I have some jays that will come through and find them out. Because that's usually when I'm traveling to southern Utah, there's a bed and breakfast that we love to stay at in Teasdale, and that's what wakes me up in the morning is I hear those pinion jays outside just creating a racket, and I love it.
Yes, beautiful noise.
So with you mentioned that it's drought tolerant, average soil,
again,
mm-hmm. full sun,
mm-hmm.
Will grow a little faster in partial shade.
Yes.
That seems counterintuitive. Why is that?
I don't know. it doesn't have to spend as much energy absorbing or reflecting the sun's rays. And I found this out just by accident because I threw out some pine nuts one winter. They came up underneath my Quakeys, and that tree easily grew a foot a year, which is unusual.
Wow, that's quite a bit.
It is. And a couple of years ago, Utah State came down and they did a little research plot there, trying to figure out if there was a way to get the pinions to grow faster, because that's the one reason that people might not want it in their yard. They want a tree that grows fast, like an Austrian pine, right?
Mm.
And so they did research growing them covered, in shade, without shade, with the fertilizer, without fertilizer, and the ones in the shade did grow a little bit faster.
Okay. Well, and I don't want a tree that grows too fast.
Right.
Because I don't want to have to deal with all the problems that a faster growing tree produces.
Well, I agree.
So this
it's perfect for that reason.
And talk about its unique fragrance.
Well, I like to identify trees, especially pine trees, by they all have some kind of a unique fragrance. And pinions just have this really wonderful aroma, this fragrance. You brush the needles, nothing else has that smell. Nothing else in the world has that pinion smell to it.
And I love if there's a little bit of sap.
Oh, yeah.
You don't want to get it on your clothes, but I just love to take the sap and rub it between my fingers and just smell it.
Smell it.
It's so good. And you also have use it as a screen, windbreak, or a specimen.
Right. They're so tough and they can tolerate, you know, they take that wind and they're compact enough, dense enough that they make a really good windbreak.
And what would you plant it with? What would you plant around it?
The plants that you would normally see growing around it in the wild would be like mountain mahogany, gamble oak. It will grow by any of those. And they all give you that same outdoorsy look.
Okay. Well, we've been talking about the pinion pine, and any variety of pinion that you would suggest than other?
This pine I'm talking about basically is edgeless, and it's a two-needle pine. It's the one that grows mostly throughout this state.
Okay. So that's the one that I have.
That's one that you have.
Yeah.
There is a real pretty blue variety up in the northwest corner of Utah that I know that some of the professors from Utah State are trying to get into the market because it's bluer needles, more compact, you know, dense. But for the most part, it's the Pinus edulis.
Like from the Raft River Mountain area.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Well, this is the Pinion Pine, and you've been listening to Going Native. Jeanette Warner has been my guest. She's owner of Wildland Nursery just south of Richfield in Joseph. Thanks for being in, Jeanette.
Oh, thank you very much.
Coming up next, it's Petals and Prose with Nancy Williams reading about squash.
Good morning. This is definitely pumpkin season and will be, I guess, for the next month. So I'd like to talk today about pumpkins and squashes in general. And I'm pulling this information from a marvelous book by Rebecca Rupp, R-U-P-P, called How Carrots Won the Trojan War. This is her chapter on pumpkins in general, but it is pumpkins and squashes, all sorts of little goodies, and I'm just pulling parts of it out. Pumpkins and squashes, so closely interconnected that many promiscuously interbreed to form misshapen but usually edible squumpkins, have bewildered botanists for centuries. Common garden classification, which inconveniently bears little resemblance to accepted botanical order, divides the multitudinous squashes into summer and winter varieties. Summer squashes ripen in summer, have delicate edible shells and seeds, and should be eaten hot off the vine since they have generally poor keeping qualities. Examples are the yellow crookneck, the bush scallop or patty pan, and the ubiquitous zucchini. Winter squashes ripen in the fall, have tough, inedible shells and hard, large seeds, and store well for periods of several months. Examples are the acorn, butternut, and Hubbard squashes, the spaghetti squash, and the orange top-knotted turban. Pumpkins, botanically lumped with the summer squashes, behave persistently like winter squashes, and many early naturalists and travelers seem to have used the name pumpkin simply to indicate any fruit inordinately big and round. Amid all the varieties, squashes come in an immense array of shapes, many of them bizarre, and in colors ranging from tan, cream, and orange to blue, black, and salmon pink, pumpkins distinguish themselves in the matter of sheer size. Joshua Hempstead, an 18th century Connecticut colonist, noted in his diary for 1721, "Wednesday 20th, saw a pumpkin 5'11" round." Like Joshua, few of us can resist the unusually enormous, or apparently keep ourselves from getting into fights over the precise size of them, which is why Sir Hugh Beaver in 1955 instituted the Guinness Book of World Records. He hoped by providing incontrovertible data to eliminate brawling in pubs. Surprisingly, Thomas Jefferson, a man obsessed with size, seems never to have measured a pumpkin. Jefferson, in the 1780s, was engaged in the scientific equivalent of a pub brawl with George Louis Leclerc over, continentally speaking, whose was bigger than whose. Buffon, in his Natural History, published in 44 volumes between 1749 and 1809, insisted that America was degenerate, its native inhabitants, animals, and plants all smaller, weaker, and generally punier than their European counterparts. Incensed, Jefferson countered with black bears, beavers, elk, and moose, all far larger than the next best European equivalents, and dispatched Lewis and Clark on their cross-country expedition with instructions to find something huge to end the argument, ideally a living mammoth. The pumpkin, however, even though Jefferson planted 8 acres of them on each of his plantations for feeding his livestock, seems never to have crossed his mind as a counter in the size debate. Perhaps the Jeffersonian pumpkins were just too small. The modern obsession with giant pumpkins has its roots in the competitive state agricultural fairs of the 19th century, where farmers and gardeners vied to win prizes for the biggest and the best. The giant pumpkin that first won America's fancy, according to Amy Goldman and Victor Schrager, authors of The Compliant Squash, 2004, was an import from France. A variety of Cucurbita maxima, known as the Jaune Gros de Paris, or Large Yellow Paris. Among the first to grow those in the United States was Henry David Thoreau, who, having obtained seeds from the U.S. Patent Office, managed to produce a 123.5-pounder, with which he won a prize at the Middlesex Fair. He subsequently sold his squash, in quotes, to a buyer who planned to make a profit by selling the seeds for 10 cents apiece, a pretty penny back then. Soon renamed the mammoth, Chaon Grow rapidly became ubiquitous in American gardens. In 1875, the delighted Mr. James Rister of Bethany, Missouri, wrote to seedman J.J. H. Gregory, from whom he had purchased seeds of the mammoth French squash, quote, "I must brag a little, for I believe, from the seed I had of you, I raised the largest squash in the world. It weighed over 300 pounds. Giant pumpkins today have passed the 500, 1,000, and 1,500 pound marks, with apparently no end in sight. The world champion as of 2010 weighed in at 1,810 pounds, approximately the weight of a Volkswagen Beetle. The pumpkin is an American icon. It has been immortalized in prose and poetry by such literary greats as Mother Goose, Washington Irving, John Greenleaf Whittier, and L. Frank Baum. And few autumns pass without somebody quoting James Whitcomb Riley's colloquial tribute to the time when the frost is on the pumpkin. Henry David Thoreau tossed it a left-handed compliment, reflecting on the solitary banks of Walden Pond that he would rather sit on a pumpkin and have it all to himself than on a velvet cushion and be crowded. And in 1697, master storyteller Charles Perrault provided his Cinderella with the best of both, transforming a solitary pumpkin into a velvet cushioned coach to carry her in cucurbital elegance to the Prince's Ball. Since 1959, we've been able to sympathize each Halloween with Charles Schulz's character Linus, patiently waiting for the great pumpkin to rise out of the pumpkin patch and fly through the air, delivering toys to all the good children of the world. Best of all the pumpkin tales, however, may be one of Aesop's fables. It tells of a man who lay beneath an oak tree, criticizing the creator for hanging a tiny acorn on a huge tree, but an enormous pumpkin on a slender vine. Then, the story goes, an acorn fell and hit him on the nose. Native American gardens offered many varieties of squash. The northeastern tribes grew pumpkins, yellow crooknecks, patty pans, Boston marrows, perhaps the oldest squash in America still in commercial production, and turban squashes. Southern tribes raised winter crookneck, kushaws, and green and white striped sweet potato squashes. The Indian name for the fruit translated as something to be eaten raw. Probably the earliest but least satisfactory means of consumption. Most successful among squashes today is probably the zucchini, which became popular in American gardens in the 1950s, reintroduced to North America from Italy. The Italians had acquired the zucchini in mysteriously undocumented fashion more than 300 years ago and formed an immediate affinity for it. The name is a derivative of an Italian word meaning sweetest. It's also legendarily productive. Six zucchini plants, one expert figures, yield an average of 50 pounds of fruit per summer, and that's a conservative estimate. The trouble is, you cannot grow just one zucchini, humorist Dave Berry writes. Minutes after you plant a single seed, hundreds of zucchini will barge out of the ground and sprawl around the garden, menacing the other vegetables. At night, you'll be able to hear the ground quake as more and more zucchini erupt. Adventurous squash eaters do not necessarily confine themselves to the conventional fleshy fruits. Squash flowers, especially those of zucchini, patty pan, and summer crookneck, are both edible and flavorful. Friar Bernardino de Saguan reported squash blossom hors d'oeuvres at Montezuma's banquet table, though he was regrettably vague about their manner of preparation. These days, the blossoms are sautéed, dipped in batter for fritters, or stuffed with rice and meat. The Zunis of the Southwest ate squash blossoms in soup, choosing the large male flowers, which were considered the most delectable. I like to make squash soup myself, and I'll bet you do too. I have a pretty easy recipe for squash and apple soup that almost anyone can do without failing. That's the kind of recipe I like the best, so I thought I'd share it with you today. It's called Squash and Apple Soup, and it is from one of my favorite falling apart cookbooks called Too Many Tomatoes, a cookbook for when your garden explodes by Lois M. Burroughs and Laura G. Myers. So here we go. Here's how you do squash and apple soup for six people. One medium winter squash, which you bake at 425 until it's done, which is about 45 minutes to an hour. Then you cut it in half and remove the pulp and seeds. To that, you add 3 tart green apples, chopped. You don't have to peel them. 1 onion, chopped. 1/4 teaspoon of dried rosemary. 1/4 teaspoon of dried marjoram. 4 cups of chicken broth. 1 teaspoon of salt. 1/8 of a teaspoon of pepper. And 1/4 teaspoon of curry powder. Combine all that and simmer for 45 minutes. Then add the squash pulp. Blend well in the blender. Or use my favorite appliance, which I call a little boat motor. It's the portable immersible blender that you can stick right in the soup pot. And that's it. You serve it with fresh parsley on the top. And you can do it as a first course, or you can do it as a casual meal that includes cold ham, French bread, and butter. Reheat it before serving. It keeps in the fridge just fine. You could probably freeze it, although I never have because I never have enough left over to freeze. But give it a try. I love it. You can find that squash soup recipe on the UPR website. And thank you so much for listening and listening to my stories this morning. I will see you next time. This is Nancy Williams, Petals and Prose.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.